This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Funded with a pledge to do its part to avert a meltdown.
Here's a glimpse at the closing numbers. Don't look too long, because it'll hurt.
Global responses.
A secret plan to build a financial firewall.
Standard & Poor's has lowered the country's credit rating by one notch to A. It's just five steps above junk status.
Even the police, battling protesters for months, have seen their salaries cut by between 200 and 600 euros a month.
Stagnation in the advanced economies.
No, there's no easy way out.
Poor's has lowered the country's credit rating by one notch to A. It's just five steps.
It's a fine time for bad news bears. World floods continue, this time in Asia. The Arctic has an ozone hole. Oh, yeah, and the global financial system is on the edge of bankruptcy. Our first guest says people who care about the environment need to pay attention to the ongoing mega bailouts in Europe, maybe coming back to America soon. Those last financial resources, the billions and trillions that could have funded conversion to safe energy, are swirling down the drain. We are passing the toxic banking mess to our children. Let them pay. After a quick trip to Europe, we'll pull back to a shocking revelation from science. Alder Stone Fuller teaches us about Type 2 climate change, the fast, violent kind, which can shake civilization down in less than a decade. This is not a movie or crank disaster porn. Don't miss our extended interview with Alder Stone Fuller, complete with readings from The End of the Long Summer with author Diane Dumanoski.
The hard truth is that there are no solutions that can simply halt this planetary emergency, stop the dramatic changes that are already underway, and save the world we have known.
In just a moment, you'll hear from the Automatic Earth.
Organizers of the Occupy Wall Street protest are angry at government bank bailouts.
Scuffles in New York between the police and demonstrators calling themselves Occupy Wall Street appeared on YouTube as activists tweeted that dozens of people have been arrested. The group is using social media to call for peaceful protests against what they describe as corporate greed in America.
I've been here on and off since Saturday, and I'm going to be here as long as it takes.
Occupy Wall Street organizers say they intend to continue their so-called occupation for change indefinitely.
This is Radio EcoShock.
There's no way to avoid the ongoing disaster in world banking circles. Our next guest says we should pay attention because politicians and bankers are selling off our future. We may have no money to pay for mass transit, solar conversion, or any project to save ourselves from peak oil or climate change. Are we entering a new feudal age where 99% of us are debt slaves? We'll go now to a man whose blog rings true for millions of people. Writing as Ilargi, our guest dives into the latest banking fantasies, looking for reality. From the Automatic Earth, Ilargi, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to be here.
I wanted our listeners to hear you, Ilargi, because even though you're a financial writer and Radio EcoShock is mainly environmental, you wrote that people concerned with the environment should watch these financial bailouts carefully. Why do you say that?
Specifically because I think that maybe people who focus on the environment right now are missing out on the financial crisis, which is much more urgent, which is a much shorter time frame. And by missing out on that, they risk getting us into a situation where their children, for whom they wish to preserve the environment, will have no choice but to destroy it, because they will have nothing left. You can imagine a situation in which people burn every last tree simply because they're cold. We tend to think more from a situation of luxury.
And you don't think that luxury is going to continue?
Not the way we're going now.
Well, getting to that trigger point for the European crisis that everybody writes about, we know that Greece entered the European Union fraudulently. Goldman Sachs helped Greece to hide those mountains of debt in some shadow banking system. Do you think that Goldman Sachs undermined the European Union?
In that sense, yeah. I would rather put it in more broad strokes, though. I don't think that focusing too much on Greece is all that healthy. because Greece is not the problem, and Greece is the first part of the problem that shows up. What I read a lot these days, ever since the Greek crisis really started being prominent, is that if only we would do that, or if only we would do that, and it's the fault of the politicians who don't take the right measures. And look, you have a lot of that kind of comment, and I think it's all bogus. I think the entire situation is completely, there's no solution for it.
Well, I'm reading that in your blog. You seem to be getting sort of fed up and almost wishing the whole thing would blow up. It might be better for us. Is that how you feel?
Well, that sounds very negative, Alex. I think, and I've written this repeatedly, what had to happen is all the assets held in bank vaults have to be marked to market. There's far too much stuff in bank vaults that nobody has put any valuation on. And so there's a lot of stuff that's in their vaults for 100 cents on the dollar, and it's only worth 10 cents on the dollar. And it's time that we recognize the real financial situation of the banks. Because, you know, what a lot of the politicians say these days with all this bailout money is that it's to restore the confidence in the market. But how are you going to restore confidence in the market if the markets know that there's still a lot of paper, trillions of dollars worth of paper in bank vaults that everybody refused to put, let's say, a true valuation on?
What if these banks actually come clean and it turns out they're totally bankrupt? Then what do we do?
Then they have to go bankrupt.
But our money's in there.
And what we should do as societies is ring-fence, is a popular word, ring-fence the deposits of the people rather than saving the banks. The story we are fed is not true. You know, the story we are fed is that we have to save the banks because that's the way we will save ourselves. But if the banks are too deep in debt, that's not going to work, is it?
And the same goes for countries.
The idea is that if $1 trillion of public money doesn't work, make it five, and that should work. But so far we haven't proven that, have we? So maybe it's time for a different tack.
What sort of tactic? Well, you said you.
Well, exactly. Marking all the debt to market, and whoever is too deep in debt will have to be restructured and default and maybe go bankrupt.
My problem with that is, you know, I've got a little bit of a pension, and I know that that's somewhere in this banking system, and I've got I hope my bank account will open next week. So if these banks go bankrupt, it could go global, and what happens to my pension?
Well, yeah, but why would you presume that the present bailout rump would save your pension?
Well, that's a question I don't have an answer for.
No, I think that will be typical of a lot of people. We are fed the idea that there is a solution to this. You know, there must be a solution to this, but maybe there's not. I mean, pension plans are Ponzi schemes, you know, they're pyramid schemes, in the sense that you will always need fresh input, and the fresh input will always have to be bigger than the older input. That's the pyramid model.
But that can't happen because, in fact, in many of the Western countries, there are fewer younger people working compared to the baby boomers who are expecting to collect the pensions.
This is where we say bingo.
Well, you know, here in North America, this is being covered as a European banking crisis.
Yeah, they like that.
There are a lot of connections and risks for Americans. Can you talk about that?
The fact that the Americans like so much to talk about this as a European issue is, first of all, to take attention away from their own problems. I was just reading an article today, I think it was in The Guardian, about underwater mortgages in the States. Well, who's talking about underwater mortgages these days? Not a lot of people, because everybody likes to talk about Greece, right? I think the U.S. itself is in very, very deep shit, and maybe Greece is a little bit worse, but it can't be that much. Plus, Greece is a lot smaller than the U.S. But there's also a lot of banking connections. Morgan Stanley came under fire at the end of last week, and that is primarily because it has a lot of ties to French banks, which have a lot of ties to Greek banks, which have a lot of ties to the Greek government, because everybody, both the Greek banks and the French banks all own a lot of Greek sovereign debt. And then Morgan Stanley has a lot of links to the French banks. And one thing that is hardly mentioned these days is derivatives. And apparently Morgan Stanley still has a $56 trillion derivative portfolio, if I remember well. And of course, Morgan Stanley is very closely connected to all the other banks on Wall Street, and It's a simple story, really.
And you're in Europe now, are you?
I'm now in Europe, yeah.
And there seems to be news coming out every day about another failure. Denmark just put $72 billion into their banks to keep them from bankruptcy. And then we have the Dexia failure right next door to you there in Belgium.
Yeah. Those are two relatively new stories. I don't really know that much about Denmark. They haven't been in the news at all. One of the things I mentioned to Tony, my co-editor, is that we never hear about the Danish krona as a safe haven currency, you know, which is something you do hear about a Canadian dollar or the Norwegian in general terms. But Denmark has been uncharted territory a bit so far.
Well, they don't have the oil that the Norwegians have. The Norwegians have saved up this gigantic investment fund, so they sound like a safer bet, I'll grant you. But Dexia is the largest lender to local governments in Belgium, and it's borrowed more than any other bank from the U.S. Federal Reserve System. At one point, they had $31 billion from the U.S.
58 at one point.
They've had two rescues already, and now the talk is they may have to be nationalized. Well, that just means passing the losses on to the taxpayers.
But it's more complicated because Dexia is the largest lender to French municipalities. You know, and France is a lot bigger country than Belgium. I think the origin of Dexia is Belgian, but it's now half French, half Belgian, and they're talking about a joint bailout as well. Both the Belgian government and the French government are working on a bailout plan. The problem now for this, and you read that in the next bailout schemes being concocted for Europe as well, you know, if the stability mechanism would be leveraged to 2 trillion from the present 220 or 440 billion, whichever number you take, then Standard & Poor's has already said that they're going to take a very close look at the credit rating of both Germany and France. And if France, with the shaky banks that they have, like Société Générale lost God knows how much money in the past few months, market capitalization, like 60 or 70% or something in just a few months' time. And that, of course, has a lot to do with the French government. Now, if France would also bail out Dexia, then Standard & Poor's may look very closely at the French credit rating anyway, you know?
You know, Ilargi, and we are talking with Ilargi, and his blog with Stone Lay at theautomaticearth.com is one of the most popular financial blogs on the net.
It's still .blogspot.com. It'll soon be .com.
Okay, .blogspot.com.
Right.
I wanted to say, many of us admire Europeans for their pleasant standard of living, their health care, their vacation time, and now that seems to be all going down the drain. It's darkening prospects around the world. Is this European dream over?
To a large part, I would think so, yeah. The dream part of it certainly is, yeah. If you define the dream as the Greeks and the Portuguese having the same standard of living as the Dutch and the Germans, because that is sort of what the Eurozone dream, at least, was about, yeah. I think the underlying dream, if you look at the European Union, was more for Germany and Holland to gain export markets. You know, so the idea was first to pour a lot of money into the periphery, the poorer countries in Southern Europe, and then have these people buy all your products.
Well, they poured the money in, that's for sure.
Yeah. No, but you can read a lot of analyses that are largely true, saying that Germany has profited more from the European Union than any other country because they sell so much more to other European countries now. So the export dream has come true to an extent, but is as you say, is ending now.
What are you hearing as you travel in Europe?
A lot of denial. We just left France and came to Holland last night, and I saw one news ticker that said there was an economics professor here in Holland who said that Holland's on the verge of an enormous housing crisis. Because home prices really haven't come down here yet. And that's amazing. I mean, it's a very overpopulated country. But still, you know, it's not about home values or how many people want homes. In the end, it's all about a credit crunch. And if there's no credit, then nobody is going to buy a home.
Well, let's say there is a major collapse. Some French banks close, government services are slashed, and we get minimum services. It could happen here in North America. It is happening here in North America. What happens to us common people on the ground?
In France, it means that tractors are going to drive their way into the Champs-Élysées in Paris, because that's what always happens in France, right? I mean, they know one thing, it's how to protest. in the U.S., you have the Occupy Wall Street movement now. Yeah, I think that's inevitable all over the world. I mean, I would never propagate revolution, but yeah, I mean, if you squeeze people hard enough, then they're going to say, ow, that hurts. Stop that.
Yeah, there are protests happening around North America. They're not big yet, but they could be the start of something big. People are angry about banking fraud and the way government seems to be sold out.
Well, you know, what I read about the Occupy Wall Street movement is, and I sympathize in general with them, is I have to wonder what these people know, what their level of knowledge is about it. I mean, to say that it's all banking fraud or it's the fault of the banks. Look, the banks can only do what politicians allow them to do. In general, I think what you have in Europe, what you have in North America, is if you allow money to enter politics, then money will buy politics, will buy the political system. And it's very hard to get it out again.
Well, one of the things I enjoy about your writing at theautomaticearth.blogspot.com, you poke pins in the balloons floated by these big financial players. I mean, these bailout funds that can be suddenly multiplied by trillions of euros or dollars, they just hit a computer key. How can we comprehend sort of fantasy money at the top like that?
What we can comprehend is that this crisis we're in, the financial part of it, not the political part of it, that's a different chapter, but the financial part of it is a debt crisis. Like, I think a lot of people can understand that. Like from individuals to governments to companies, certainly banks, everybody has borrowed too much. Everybody has too much debt. And then if you read about the European bailout fund, that there is a plan which apparently came from Tim Geithner, which was sort of funny, which basically suggests that they put 1.6 trillion euros in pure debt in this thing just by leveraging it. And like, leverage is how we got here. How can it be the way out then? Can you really solve too much debt with more debt?
Well, if my Visa card is overloaded, I can just go get another Visa card and borrow some more and pay it back with that. That should work.
Right. You think so? Oh, I think that ends somewhere. I think maybe we're at that point, or just about. Well, both the politicians and the industrial leaders, I always often put brackets between leaders, or quotation marks, not brackets, quotation marks. And a lot of the industrial leaders, banking leaders, political leaders, owe their positions to the status quo, to the system that we have now. So they'll do anything to try and save that system. And you voted them in and thereby gave them unlimited access to your money. So they can take your money from here to Christmas and keep on spending it, trillion after trillion after trillion, and then they start in your kids' money and your grandkids' money. I think it has to stop somewhere.
Is there a financial reality with real wealth? What would that look like?
Real wealth? Well, there's 1% of the American population that seems to have real wealth. I think the other 99% really has to wonder and worry about their wealth.
Ilargi, is there anything you'd like to add or leave with our listeners as we wrap up?
I don't know. I was just getting started, but so let's do another one soon then, Alex.
Okay, we'll do that. I know we can have a good long conversation. Right now you're traveling. It's not such a good time, but let's get back again.
We will. That's good.
Our guest has been the financial blogger Ilargi, a constant contributor to the blog The Automatic Earth. A new entry comes out several times a week. I read them all. You should too. Ilargi, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
The door to the comfortable and familiar world we depend on has already slammed shut behind us. It is already too late to prevent global warming or to solve the climate crisis. Too late to prevent powerful forces from altering the trajectory of human history. That we have already crossed some ominous thresholds, however, does not mean that it is too late to do anything at all. We humans are at a critical juncture, an historical moment that requires courage and sober realism. We cannot bank on the end of the world or deliverance from the trials of existence, whether through biblical apocalypse or our own extinction, nor can we proceed on blind faith in technological salvation. Fear, despair, and denial are indulgences we cannot afford. It is time to turn and face the future head on.
That was a reading from The End of the Long Summer, Why We Must Remake Our Civilization to Survive on a Volatile Earth by the author Diane Dumanoski. With record floods, droughts, and fires all over the world, you are allowed to ask, has the climate already tipped? If not, we are certainly seeing what a major climate shift could look like. We're going to talk about a sudden, even violent shift of climate here on planet Earth. Could it happen, and what could we do? Alderstone Fuller has 4 degrees, starting with biology, probability theory and statistics, and finally his doctorate in ecology and biological evolution. He is qualified to teach in universities, but Alder prefers smaller institutions, including the Euglena Academy in Eugene, Oregon, during the early 2000s. He's just moved himself and his seminars to northern New England. Alder teaches, writes, hikes, and he dances a bit while developing his theories of a whole and living world called Gaia. Alder Stone, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. A pleasure to be here.
I spent 20 years trying to stop climate change. You say it's too late for that. That's a big subject that we will return to, but can you briefly tell us why do you think it's too late?
Well, first, I apologize for the bad news, and second, I want to make it clear that these really aren't my theories. I'm not developing these. I'm actually working more with the ideas that are being put forth by the people that I think are Earth's best climate scientists. At the top of the list for me is Dr. James Lovelock of Britain. I study and teach his ideas quite extensively. In terms of why we probably, I always put that word probably in because of my background in probability theory, because we probably cannot stop climate change at this point, large-scale climate change, for a number of reasons. One, something called CO2 residence time. The excess CO2 that's in the atmosphere now will not drop out immediately, even if we completely stop producing greenhouse emissions tomorrow. If we go to zero emissions tomorrow, what's up there now is still going to be up there 100 years from now or longer. That's one. I can talk more extensively about that. Two, there are already at least 8 major global-scale positive feedback processes that are kicking in. And positive feedbacks, unlike negative feedbacks, positive feedbacks accelerate trends. So since we're already heating, positive feedback will heat us faster. And I can talk, if you wish, more about those 8 positive feedback processes. And then there's a couple of other phenomena. For example, just like a car going 70 miles per hour on an interstate can't be stopped on a dime, the climate system can't be stopped on a dime. It's got an inertia to it. So even if we stop producing greenhouse gases tomorrow, we're still going to continue to heat for a while. And there's also, fourth, there's a phenomenon called global dimming. It's caused by aerosol pollution in the upper atmosphere. Most of that is sulfur dioxide being produced by burning fossil fuels, dirty fossil fuels. Aerosols produce clouds, and that tends to artificially cool us. So in reality, we are probably 1 to 3 degrees centigrade warmer than we think we are, because those clouds are up there cooling us artificially. And if we stop burning fossil fuels tomorrow, those sulfur dioxides will drop out of the atmosphere very quickly, a matter of weeks, weeks to months, and we'll heat immediately, at least as much as we heat in the entire 20th century. So if you put all those together, it's a logical argument that we probably can't stop large-scale change at this point. We should try. We'd be foolish not to try. We should pull out the stops, but we probably can't stop it.
Well, listeners, we've run into something more than a man with a theory. This is deep science and deep ecology, and it's going to take some digging. Alder, let us introduce your program with a kind of table of contents. Could you give us a brief outline of the 4 steps in your approach, the type 2 change, the emotions, and the adaptability, and the new science? So what are you going for there?
Good question, Alex. I think the place to start, well, the place that I start, at least in my program to try to help communities understand this, people in communities understand it, is step number one probably is to help people understand the distinction between type 1 climate change and type 2 climate change. And 1 and 2 here is usually written with a Roman numeral. Type 1 climate change is mostly what you're hearing in mainstream media coming from the body called IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that UN-mandated and funded group, who's done a wonderful job over the last 20 years or so, starting in the early 1990s, of assessing the current state of climate science. There's 1,500 or so renowned climate scientists from around the world, from virtually every nation, and their job is about every 5 years to evaluate the published studies about climate and try to see where we are now with the climate question and make projections for the century. And they do a good job. They're knowledgeable people, but they're hamstrung by the political process. Every government in the world, rather, has line item veto on anything that they don't like. And so even though the climate scientists understand more than they're putting forth, the politicos don't like that, and so they restrict what the reports say. As a result, add to that the fact that IPCC models are missing most of those positive feedbacks. That's a whole story in itself. So their projections tend to look like an elevator ride, a slow, gradual heating through this century, so that by 2100 we may be somewhere between 4 and 8 degrees centigrade warmer than now. And that's type one climate change, smooth, gradual, predictable. What we know from unequivocal data, both empirical data, mainly from the ice core studies, and from theoretical results, much of what I teach that I'll talk about next, climate change normally is not type one. It's not gradual and smooth. It's very rapid and abrupt. It may be smooth for a while. It has been for the last 10,000 years. Abnormally so, we don't know why the last 10,000 years have been so smooth and stable. But during ice ages, climate can change as much in a single decade as it has in the last 10,000 years. And that's more typical. Really rapid, large, extreme changes. That's type two. So whereas the IPCC is projecting type one, what we're really looking at is type two.
Hold on. Let's stop there because I think that is really so important. And I want our listeners to know that this idea of rapid climate change is not fringe science. In January 2010, I interviewed Dr. Michael McCracken. He's one of America's leading scientists. He was a principal author of a collection of papers called Sudden and Disruptive Climate Change. We've talked to Dr. Bob Spicer of Open University in UK, who's described these previous greenhouse worlds for us and how fast they can change. We've all seen, Alder, these graphs of the IPCC, and they just go slowly up to 2100. And you're saying, no, we could have a big jump, and it could be starting right now, or it could be starting in 2020. Is that it?
That is correct. And what more to the point, I guess, what I'm saying, and this is what James Lovelock and others are saying as well, the jump has already started. We're on the bottom end of a really rapid upswing. And the biggest jump, Lovelock believes, because of a model that he and geophysicist Lee Kump produced and published in Nature, Journal Nature, in 1992. They predict an 8 degree centigrade jump somewhere between now and 2050, mid-century or so. Now that's 8 degrees total. It's on top of what we've already increased. So we've already increased 1 degree. Think about the next couple of decades or so, another couple of degrees centigrade, and then a big pop from there up to a total of 8 degrees centigrade. Is that going to happen? Nobody knows, but the evidence, both empirical and theoretical, behind it is very strong, and we'd be foolish not to take these ideas into account.
Well, I think that leads into another question. We'll get away from our outline here maybe, because you especially recommend two books, and the first one seems to fit into what you just said, and it's Deep Survival, Who Lives, Who Dies, and Why by Lawrence Gonzalez. Why is that relevant?
Another good question. Lawrence Gonzalez has spent his life studying situations in which people have gotten themselves into very dangerous life-threatening situations, mountaineering accidents, airplane accidents, life-threatening illness, war survivors, POWs, etc. And what he found is that there are about 12 components of a mindset that one needs in order to get through one of those life-threatening situations. For example, the first one, and I think it's most relevant in this case, is don't sugarcoat the truth. Admit that you're in deep trouble and you may die. And you've just got to deal with it. You've got to get your mindset around that. So in his second book, which I also recommend, called Everyday Survival, Why Smart People Do Stupid Things, that is, how do people get into life-threatening situations in the first place by not paying attention, he makes the point that we need, as a species now, we need to adopt these ideas of deep survival for our current situation. We're facing a very large planetary crisis with this climate change, and that's not even to mention peak oil and other problems that we're facing. We've got some big issues to deal with, and it's no sense sugarcoating the truth. We need to grab the bull by the horn, so to speak, and say, okay, this is a serious problem. Let's get on about doing something about this.
And the other book which continues to pop up in your work is The End of the Long Summer, Why We Must Remake Civilization to Survive on a Volatile Earth, and that is by Diane Dumanoski. Tell us about that one.
It's the most, it's one of the two most important books on climate change that I would recommend for everyone to read right now. That's probably the top of my list. Diane Dumanoski has been a journalist with the Boston Globe for, I think, 30 years, actually close to 40, and she started with her reporting on the Earth Day in 1970. And this book, especially Chapter 4, deals with climate change in the most realistic and accessible way. By accessible, I mean to the average lay reader. She lays it out. She understands Type 2 climate change, and she understands well that we probably cannot stop it at this point, and therefore, she argues, we need to start, in addition to mitigating to the extent that we can, we need to start getting ready for Type 2 climate change, because our kids are going to live on effectively a different planet. It's still going to be Earth, but it's going to look like a different planet. So she recommends remaking our communities effectively by what she calls shock-proofing, that is, proofing our systems to meet our basic needs of water and food, shelter, energy, even security, shockproofing those against what's coming. I've been working for about 2 years on a project called the Adaptability Project that we're just starting to bring online to help communities do just that, and I can talk more about it later if you want to.
I would like to. I'd like to pick up on that perhaps in the second part of our interview. But in the meantime, you're talking about very frightening things. Agriculture and our food supply is in danger. Millions will be made homeless. In fact, you suggest billions could die as the climate wheels out of control. Do you really believe there will be a mass die-off?
Well, unfortunately, it's likely, very likely. And again, I was first brought to awareness about this by James Lovelock, and his last two books, notably The Revenge of Gaia, I think is his penultimate book. It was reading that, and that really sort of clicked for me the human toll that this is likely to exact. His opinion is that by 2100, by the end of the century, that we're likely to lose all but around a half a billion people. That is, the population, human population of the planet would decrease from its current, we're right at 7 billion, down to less than a half a billion, 500 million people. Most of those living quite a bit in the far north, Canada and around the Arctic Circle. That's sort of the level of severity that he sees that we're facing. In his opinion, most continents south of, let's say, Canada, the Arctic Circle, most continents will desertify and will lose agriculture as we know it in those regions.
Well, as people see what's happening, events they never expected in their lifetimes, they do go into a state of paralysis resembling the moments after a car wreck. I call it eco-shock. That's the name of this program. We've had psychologists on the show suggesting ways to cope. What are some of the things you teach people in your seminars and online courses about coping with this bad news?
Let me, if I can, give you my website, because there's an essay that I want to recommend that people read on it. The website is www.alderstone3.com. And if you go to my section on essays, there's an essay there called Facing and Surviving Climate Change with Honest Hope. It's a collection of quotes from Lawrence Gonzalez, Diane Dumanoski, and James Lovelock about how do we psychologically deal with the gravity of the situation? How can we get past what Dumanowski refers to as fear, despair, and denial. One of the quotes that I offer in the essay is her quote, and I'm paraphrasing here, I don't remember it precisely, but she basically says, we don't have time for fear, despair, and denial. We really need to wrap our minds around what's going on. We need to understand it. We need to feel what we need to feel psychologically, and then we need to get on with dealing with this. So I think that essay will help answer your question.
On a personal note, Alder, you moved from Oregon to New England. Can you tell us why and what you're doing now in the Northeast?
Alex, I lived on the West Coast for about 13 years. I finished my doctoral studies in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 1990. I taught there in a community college for about 8 years, a really great experience. And then I moved up to the Pacific Northwest, specifically to Olympia, Washington, and then decided to open my own academy where I could teach these ideas that I teach now, system sciences, geophysiology, also called Gaia theory. I like the word geophysiology, the physiology of an entire planet, all applied to biological systems and climate change, classes on climate change. So I opened the academy in Eugene in the year 2001, and it was called Euglena Academy. It's a biological word, Euglena. It's a little microbe that seeks light. And taught courses, 25 different courses from introductory to advanced around those topics of system sciences and geophysiology. And I taught there for about 10 years and enjoyed the stay, had many wonderful friends and students there. But I'm sort of quasi-nomadic. I get wanderlust. And I'd been on the West Coast for about 13 years and decided, I have some friends here in Maine, so I decided to come over here and hang out for a while. I love it here. Maine is just a beautiful, beautiful place with an amazing culture. So instead of having one studio here, one place, like a storefront, like I did in Eugene, what I'm doing here is a more mobile format, moving between communities. Right now I'm very near Skowhegan, Maine, or Skowhegan as they call it, but I also want to teach, and I taught one class down in Lewiston last spring, and I want to move around to various communities teaching these ideas.
Well, we're going to continue with Alder Fuller in just a minute. We've kind of run out of time for this session. Check out alderstone3.com. In our next interview with Alder, you will hear his suggestions more about what we can do, some real-world tips to prepare, and then how to boost your knowledge of the big picture. We really need to go back to school, all of us, with this new science and to understand what Gaia science is about. Thank you so much, Alder, and let's continue our discussion.
You're welcome, Alex. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith. Stay tuned for Alder Fuller, Part 2, on Radio EcoShock.
The future in the modern imagination has always stretched out ahead, like a broad highway drawing us onward with the promise of tomorrow. Now, rather suddenly, as it becomes impossible to ignore dramatic physical changes taking place across the Earth, the future looms like an urgent question. Whatever the coming century brings, it will not unfold smoothly as some improved but largely familiar version of life as we know it. This is the only thing that seems certain.
Diane Dumanowski, The End of the Long Summer. If we've learned one thing about rapid climate change, it's this. We don't know how it will unfold. Will it be drought or flood or alternating years of each? As just happened in Texas, they had record wetness in 2010 and now record drought and heat in 2011. Or what if the problem is expressed as seasonal instability, like the summer weather now in the UK, causing flowers to bloom at the wrong time? There are sunbathers on the beaches of Britain on the 1st of October with temperatures in the 80s. It's crazy stuff. We don't know how the insects, the plants, the diseases will shift, and we don't really know what to prepare for because we don't know what's coming. So let's return to our guest, biologist and systems thinker, Alder Stone Fuller. In our last session, Alder Stone said climate change is upon us and probably cannot be stopped. We briefly discussed how to handle that personally and emotionally. Now, I want to talk about what we can do and what we shouldn't do. So, Alder Stone, what should governments and groups avoid when it comes to climate shift preparation?
They should avoid falling into the trap of thinking that climate change is going to be type 1, like we talked about in the first part of the interview. preparing for type 1 climate change, in my opinion, will not adequately prepare you for type 2, which again is the rapid, abrupt, even chaotic, and certainly extreme kind of climate change that we're likely to face. Too many people in our culture over the last decade or more have come to understand this idea of global warming as a slow, gradual elevator ride to a warmer temperature, such that we'll be able to pleasantly play tennis in February in the Northern Hemisphere in a t-shirt. And that's really not the true nature of climate change. Climate change is abrupt, rapid, and chaotic. So we're likely to see, as you were pointing out in your introduction a minute ago, we're likely to see as much severe winter weather as we see severe summer weather, and spring and fall, of course. Type 2 climate change is really about the extremes. It's about the rapid shifts, the variability. And in fact, Alex, if I may, we were talking in the first segment about one of my favorite books, Diane Dumanowski's The End of the Long Summer, which I would recommend is the starting point for anyone reading. It's a great, great place to start. The second book that I would recommend to read after that will help readers understand much more about type 2 climate change. The book is by the author Fred Pearce, P-E-A-R-C-E, and the title is With Speed and Violence. Subtitle is Why Climate Scientists Fear Tipping Points in Climate Systems. It's a really, really wonderful, engaging, well-written, scientifically accurate description of type 2 climate change from the perspective of many, two or three dozen top climate scientists that he has interviewed for this book. So I can't recommend that enough, With Speed and Violence by Fred Pearce. Planners, city planners, community planners, people who are helping their communities plan appropriately for climate change, need to read that book. They actually need to read both of them, Dumanowski and the Pearce book.
Then looking at what we should do, what is the difference between adaptation and adaptability?
Really a relevant question there that Dumanowski explicates very well in her book. Adaptation is preparation for a change that is relatively constant. That is, if climate were going to change from one relatively stable state like it's been for the last 10,000 years, we call this temperate climate. If it were going to change from one stable state to another stable state like the last 10,000 years, then we could adapt to that. If it was going to become consistently, let's say, hot and wet, we could adapt to that. The problem is we don't know exactly what state we're going to be in. It'll be extremely variable and chaotic. And so we can't adapt to that. So Dumanowski prefers the word adaptability. She says that our ancestors, our hominid ancestors that survived the ice ages, the brutal, extreme, chaotic ice ages, did so not by adaptation, but by being adaptable. That is, they could roll with the punches. They could survive in one environment, and then when things change rapidly again, they could survive in that as well. So she emphasizes that we need to increase our adaptability, not to plan for adaptation, but to increase our adaptability. And again, that's what she's referring to by shock-proofing our basic human needs, water and food and shelter and energy needs. We've got to be able to grow food in hot and dry conditions, hot, wet conditions, cool, wet, and cool, dry. You've got to cover all your bases. And an adaptation strategy that plans for hot and dry is not going to make it in cool and wet.
Well, you mentioned that you're something of a person who likes to move around, a bit of a nomad. I'm wondering whether, if the climate changes as rapidly as you and as James Lovelock have suggested, many of us are going to have to be nomads and move from where we are because we can't live where we are.
I fully agree. It's part of my, well, I guess I'm semi-nomadic by nature. I have been since I was in my 20s. I just have enjoyed living in various places in the country. But I think it predisposes me to the type of lifestyle that people in the mid-century may want to really consider. I can't imagine right now putting down roots in Central Texas after the summer that they've had. What was it, 40 consecutive days above 100 degrees?
Mm-hmm.
And it's still going. In Waco, Texas, over the weekend, I think they still were still in the 100 degrees. So I think it's going to be a reasonable strategy to consider by mid-century, if not before, to be able to pick up and move, which means, of course, that we need to considerably lighten our load. We don't want to be moving. Everybody moving your belongings in a big moving van, an 18-wheeler, is probably not practical. So lightening our load, living more lightly.
And I wonder, too, whether the agricultural-type answers that people are putting forward, you know, we'll plant our soil right where we are, but maybe the climate won't let you grow anything right where you are if it changes. So that leads me to ask you how you would compare the adaptability project to the transition movement.
I'm going to do sort of an A and B thing here. Good question about the transition town project, because I'm involved in one at the current time, and I really value their approach. I want to say just one word, if I can, before I forget, about agriculture. In my opinion, we need to shift from what we've been calling agriculture, especially monocropping, and especially industrial agriculture, which was problematic in the first place anyway. We need to switch from those approaches to more of a permaculture approach. Now, I know just enough about permaculture to be able to speak about it in broad general terms. I'm not at all an expert. I know a number of people who are. But I think definitely permaculture is the way to go for meeting food needs, perhaps other forms as well, but I think permaculture should probably be the focus. Now, set that aside and come back to your question about the transition town movement. As you probably know, and your listeners may know as well, it was founded by a person named Rob Hopkins in Great Britain, predominantly around the question of peak oil, petro-collapse, if you will, the fact that we're running out of readily available liquid fossil fuels, oil. A fair amount of coal left, but our economy, especially transportation, is not based on coal, it's based on oil. So they've realized for some time that when we hit that peak oil, when oil is no longer readily available, it's going to change everything, including our ability to grow food, because we use oil in tractors for fertilizers and pesticides, et cetera, et cetera. So they have built this idea of transition towns around the concept of peak oil. How do we redesign our communities so that we can live in a post-oil world? And I think their ideas are wonderful as far as they go, but as far as I can tell from studying Rob's book, his handbook on Transition Town, which I recommended for reading, and reading their website and essays and such, it looks like to me that they're still having the mindset of we're also preparing for type 1 climate change. They don't use the terms type 1 and type 2, but from what it looks like, they're preparing for type 1. There's no indication that they really get it in terms of type 2 climate change, rapid, abrupt, extreme. So if I could do one thing for the transition town movement, it would be to bring in my view of type 2 climate change based in system sciences and geophysiology or Gaia theory.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest Alder Stone Fuller. And you've mentioned the influence on your work of Sir James Lovelock, but you must be aware that Gaia theory has its critics. We've had Professor Peter Ward on Radio EcoShock. His book, The Medea Hypothesis, was suggested by the National Academy of Science. Ward says Earth is not a friendly place run by living systems, but more of an out-of-control experiment, and judging by the geological record of near extinctions, Ward says life overall seems rather suicidal. Have you read Ward's work, and how would you answer that criticism?
I have not read Dr. Ward's work. His book is on my reading list, which is unfortunately pretty long. I have read reviews of it, and in reality, I think that he and Lovelock are not necessarily as far apart as Dr. Ward thinks that they are. Lovelock and his colleague Lynn Margulis, down at University of Massachusetts Amherst, with whom, by the way, I spent 3 weeks in her lab a year ago last August, studying with her. Dr. Margulis and Dr. Lovelock co-developed the Gaia hypothesis, now Gaia theory, in the 1970s. Neither of them portray Gaia, at least in Lovelock's later writings, neither of them portray Gaia is some benevolent goddess that is a consortium of sentient beings somehow regulating the temperature and chemical composition of the atmosphere. It's not a town meeting of species. That's not the way that Gaia works. The way that I explain Gaia is this. Imagine your own you, Alex, your own metabolism and homeostasis. Metabolism is just simply the sum total of the thousands of kinds of chemical reactions that are going on inside of every one of your cells. It's the basis of your life. That's metabolism. Homeostasis is a set of processes, respiratory processes, cardiac, blood sugar controls, your nervous system, your hormone controls, your urinary system, all of which maintain the proper conditions of temperature and chemistry for your body. That's homeostasis. Gaia is simply homeostasis and metabolism at a planetary scale. It is the sum total of all the biogeochemical cycles and the natural homeostatic processes that operate at a planetary scale. Just like your homeostasis is not under your conscious control, it happens automatically even when you sleep. Gaia's homeostasis is the same way. There's not a conscious intention. The species are not collaborating to set temperature at whatever degree, at whatever level they wish. It's not the way it works. Gaia is not a sentient entity. It's an automatic homeostatic process. And they, Lovelock and Margulis, also realized that at certain times, Gaia can be brutal, more like Dr. Ward's Medea. Gaia is not benevolent, but can be pretty mean at times. And our species, our ancestors during the Ice Ages, experienced that meanness. And, of course, I'm speaking anthropomorphically there. Again, not mean in a conscious way, but sort of metaphorically.
And I want to ask, then, can civilization survive climate change?
It can, but not in its current form. I'm one of those, like Lovelock, that thinks, yeah, our human numbers are probably going to be severely reduced by the end of the century, or sometime around the end of the century. I mean, there's too many unknowns to be able to say exactly when or by how many, but I think the numbers are going to be reduced, and civilization as we know it probably will not continue. Civilization in some form, meaning being civil to each other, large cities like New York and Washington, D.C. and Atlanta, maybe not, but some form of civil society, hopefully based in permaculture as opposed to industrial agriculture. But I tend to think that our species is pretty wily and pretty intelligent. I think that we will figure it out. It's going to take some work, and it's going to take a lot of challenging times, but I think that we can survive and hopefully follow Dumanowski's recommendation and completely remake what civilization is on a much smaller scale, much more sustainable scale.
Well, as we wrap this up, I'm hoping you're going to just give us a brief talk about the Gaia 101 seminar you offer, how people can participate in that, and how they can get a taste of your work.
Thanks for asking that, Alex. If I can, I'll repeat my website again. It's www.alderstone3.com. And if you look at the top menu on the homepage, you'll see Gaia 101 take you to a set of pages that describes my new seminar. Now, I call it a new seminar. These are actually ideas that I've been teaching for almost a decade, at least some of them for almost a decade, others for only 5 years. But they're strung together, linked together in different ways now, in a new way. Gaia 101 is a seminar that's going to be both a live seminar, that is, I'll be there in person doing it, but it's also going to have an online component. The live seminar is roughly a 10-hour seminar. That is 10 hours of lectures with lots of Q&A, question and answer, and discussion. And it could be done either on a long weekend, sort of as an intensive, say, start on Friday evening and run through Sunday afternoon, or I can stretch it out over about 3 weeks. Online, it'll be about the same length, but people can join it as they wish. There's no regularly scheduled meeting times. They can simply download the seminar, study it, and ask me questions either online or by email or even by telephone. And there's three parts to Gaia 101. Briefly, they are, part one is an introduction to system sciences, ideas like system states, system attractor states, tipping points or critical thresholds, positive and negative feedback, the theory of emergence. All of that is necessary principles to understand Gaia, which is part two. And it's an introduction to Gaia theory and geophysiology, the science of studying Gaia. And then part three is about type 2 climate change, rapid, extreme, abrupt climate change. It's simply impossible to understand type 2 climate change outside of a context of system sciences and geophysiology. It's just impossible.
So we've all got a lot more to learn, and you're offering one way to approach it. And we have to run now, I'm sorry, but to find out more about Alderstone, try out the website alderstone3.com. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Download this interview and all our past programs at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me anytime. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. Thank you, Alder.
Thank you, Alex. It's a pleasure.
Some background music by Vas Pandana at soundclick.com. Our economy collage created by Kaput Radio, Australia. Thank you so much for listening, and stay tuned next week. Diane Dumanoski, The End of the Long Summer.
Chapter 9, Honest Hope. The way through the world is more difficult to find than a way beyond it. Wallace Stevens. In times of danger, bitter truths serve us better than sweet lies. The modern era has not taken us where our guiding myth promised. The belief in deliverance through progress has been shattered by developments such as the ozone hole and global warming. Our most rapid progress now may be toward making the planet uninhabitable for many kinds of life, including ourselves. The decades ahead promise unimaginable loss. Much of the world as we know it, the maple forest of the New England autumn, the coral reefs and tropical waters, the polar bears and countless other plants and animals, low-lying islands and sandy beaches, and perhaps even some of the world's coastal cities, will likely vanish in the lifetime of a child born today. These are not the dark prophecies of environmental apocalypse invoked to scare us into changing our ways, but simply inescapable consequences of the change already set in motion. Shutting off all greenhouse gases today will not stop the warming any more than shutting off the engine can stop a runaway train hurtling down a mountain, though it might switch us onto a less precipitous and calamitous track. The century ahead promises to be a wild trip.
Because he tried to frighten us.
Yeah, he was scary.
He did the political equivalent of holding a torch under your chin. and he said that this was the economic equivalent of wartime, which I presume is just bluster. If it's not bluster, then they should stop fanning around with, you know, quantitative easing and stuff and bring in radical wartime economic measures, shouldn't they?
Like dried egg.
Like dried egg, rationing, turning off the streetlights, shooting deserters. Or tax exiles, as they like to be called. if it's genuinely that bad, that's the sort of stuff we should have.
I'm willing to give my pants for parachutes.
Do I think it's tasteful? No. Do I think it should be censored? No.